Dark Dimension Studios presents Salvation, Book 1 of the Salvation series, Heaven Above, written by S.T. Fortna, read by the author. Chapter 2. The Quasquicentennial. 1. Shortly after I had my run-in with Tristan, I arrived at the outer edge of the city's east supports. My dad and the rest of the crew were already suiting up, getting ready to strap into the hoists and be lowered along the city support shafts. The crew's supply vessel was parked a little ways from the railing and gated stairway that led to the second level. The supply vessel was larger and considerably bulky compared to the air vessel that the city security uses. The front half was meant to carry up to 6 people, while the back was a row of lockers containing the various tools needed for the job. Hard hats, jackets, gloves, harnesses, ropes, canisters of sealants and primers for covering and slowing the oxidation. All that we needed was neatly locked away inside. As I came closer, I could see Elijah was wearing a hard hat with a light on the brim. Thank God, I thought. That probably meant I would be working exterior. There are many different crews that fall under the umbrella of city structure maintenance. Ours happens to specialize in maintaining the very foundation of the suspended marvel. Our crew had 16 members, not including my dad, who was the supervisor. Each of the city maintenance crews had their own slang name, but there are only a few that I particularly remember. We called ourselves scrapers because we typically just scrape off rust that is built up on the city. Then there are the buzzers, a large crew who oversaw the city's electrical systems, which included our power sources like the wind generators and solar panels. The welders were called Melties. This was a crew that a lot of people wished they were on, mainly because they were only called out to assist with other crews when needed. There are plenty of times when they would go days, sometimes weeks, without having to weld anything. Being a scraper is a full-time, year-round job. There are periods of time when we don't have to do any scraping, but it doesn't last long. This is because my dad is so good at inspecting the support shafts on a regular basis, and he is excellent at finding the smallest speck of rust. I don't have a problem with working under him. He's very good at being a supervisor, but there are times when he can be trying on my patience, which is why working with him is also stressful. The guys on the crew have a variety of names for him, like Boss Scraper, which they have abbreviated to BS. However, none of them would call him BS directly. They would use it while talking about him, but most often, he was simply called Boss. There were other nicknames they had given him, which are sometimes a little harsh, I think, but it doesn't bother me. I know they respect him. It's just like Izzy, a coworker of mine, says. At home, he's your father. At work, he's your boss. At home, you respect him as a good son should. And at work, you respect him because you're his grunt, and you never forget he's the guy that watches your back, keeping you safe. It's true. My dad was not one to throw caution into the wind. He always made sure that we were safe. He constantly checks us to make sure that we are properly secured and attached before we descend along the supports. And one of my crew, Jed, saw me approaching them. There's Bron. About time you showed up. Good old Izzy thought he was going to go home early today. My dad looked up from his clipboard and turned my way. He was already in his bright orange jacket and wearing his white hard hat. The rest of us wore yellow. Come on, Bron, suit up. You got exterior on 37 today. Izzy's already down on the second level, getting the sling attached to the winch. I nodded my head in understanding. Izzy and I were almost always paired together on the job. Izzy was an older man, probably in his late 50s. He was one who had been doing this for as long, if not longer, than my dad had. However, Izzy was quite content with being the old bat that he was. With his growing fat gut and ever-increasing bald spot, he preferred little to no extra responsibility other than being a winch operator. I'm no longer a skinny little dangler like you, he'd say. After I put on a good 60 pounds over the harness limit, not to mention I haven't dangled in one of those things for a good 10 years or more. Most of the crew had already descended to the second level of the city. Some of them may have even already gotten strapped in and were waiting to scale the massive metal beams. I walked up to one of the cabinets on the rear of the vessel marked gear and opened it, and there was a rack of orange neon jackets made of polyester. I reached in and took one that didn't look too dirty, but all of them were covered in stains and smears from sealant and primers. The one I picked had a large white blotch on the left side under the arm. I pulled it over my coat and then grabbed an equally dirty hard hat from the bottom of the jacket rack. In a small compartment on the left of the cabinet is where the gloves are kept. I picked through the thick brown gloves that had been frayed over the years of use. I closed the door of the cabinet, then locked the handle back into place. "You won't be needing to get many other supplies. Izzy already took down the rest of them for you," my dad said as he took a small card reader out of his pockets. "Good old Izzy," I said, and took my wallet out of my pants pocket, removing the identification card from within. The card is simple. It's just a picture of me from when I was 15 that doesn't really look too much like me since I've gotten older. An ID number, 798-BW-01. And finally, my living unit number, G2-008. I slid the card mag strip down the small slit of the handheld reader and replaced it back in my wallet. The reader beeped its approval, indicating that I had clocked on for my shift. "Took you a little while to get here, didn't it?" My dad put the reader back in his pocket. "There was an arrest on the way that stalled us, and, well, when we got to the greenhouses, our class had already gone inside. Not to mention the guard was a jerk and didn't just let us pass through. I wasn't going to add my little stunt with the soil regulation lab causing a delay as well." "Well, you're here now. So go down to 37 with Izzy. Strap in tight. I'll be making rounds eventually to check up on progress." I left without even bothering to reply. The chain link entrance to the stairwell was unlocked. I walked through and closed the gate tightly behind me, making a loud clank followed by the ripple of other clangings along the twisted metal wires. The second level of the city is surprisingly lower than the main level, more than one would probably have imagined. I walked down the stairs, my heavy boots clanking against the hard metal steps and feeling the small rugged bumps of the primed metal hand railing lightly tugging at my glove. The whistling of the wind is louder as it passes under the city's main streets, with gusts whipping in between the endless maze of pipelines and steel arches that are linked by hundreds of supports. The sight is immensely overwhelming when you think of all the manpower it takes to keep a city like this in full operation. The supports are linked together with an ongoing spiderweb of narrow metal mesh walkways that quiver slightly when the wind howls around them. There is no doubt that this is probably one of the more dangerous places to work. That is why safety is such an important part of the job, and luckily under my dad's supervision, there has never been a single person to fall. People have been hurt, and sometimes they've been hospitalized, but none have fallen into the white abyss. It's not the same with all crew supervisors, though. I recall many years before a particularly horrifying event of two Melties who were working on a sewer pipeline. Someone had been careless on securing a safety line to the two welders working on it. I'm not positive the details exactly, but what I heard was there was a powerful gust that unbalanced one worker, causing him to direct his torch at the other welder. The Meltie panicked and tried to back away from the torch by unclipping the line that held him secured to the winch above. He lost his grip trying to slide away and fell below the second Meltie, whom he had a second line attached to. This method of them both having a line linked to one another was supposed to be for additional safety measures. However, in this case, it turned into a nightmare. The weight of the Meltie dangling from the line underneath the other was so great that the second safety line snapped, swinging them both away from the pipe, suspending them over the abyss. Their combined weight was too much strain on the line that was retracting into the winch. It snapped and they vanished into the sea of white. I remember the memorial service all those years ago. I was 10 years old and Corey was just a baby. Everyone was either family or friends or somehow connected to the two Melties was meeting in the city square that night in front of the governing building. The mayor and the city council members offered their condolences to the family of the lost ones. And even at that age, I doubted their sincerity. I say this because it seemed to be rehearsed, and it felt more like an instructor speaking to a room of students rather than a funeral service. I can still see tears of a new widow and mother in anguish at the loss of her husband. I'll never forget the sight of a small girl, not much younger than me, with rosy cheeks and a tear-streamed face that was half buried into the hem of her mother's dress. Her name was Maybelline Taylor. That was the first time I really became aware of death and what it does to people, the unimaginable pain and loss, the constant thought of knowing that person that you loved is gone forever. I never wanted to know what that feeling was like, but I do. I remember the day of my mother's memorial service 2 years ago. Corey was 8 when Mom died, and I was 16. I tried to be strong and comforting for Corey during the procession, but I was just as distraught as she was. My dad was emotionally dormant, not showing a hint of sorrow. Maybe that was his mind's psychological defense, to whisk the pain away into a vault deep in his mind, not allowing him to show sadness. But I knew he was hurting. We all were. After the service, people who knew my mother came up to us offering what little comfort they could, but it was Maybelline that comforted me the most. She approached me and embraced me, hugging me while placing her head on my shoulder. Her touch communicated an unspoken understanding of the agony that I was facing, the constant pulling at my heartstrings knowing that my mom was gone forever. And after she hugged me, she leaned down to Corey, who stood beside us, and hugged her tightly, silently telling us she knew exactly the pain that we were feeling. I could almost hear her saying, "You're not alone." I am just like those Melties, suspended over the nothingness, relying on aged equipment. The harness I have to sit in is tightly strapped and is made of thick, heavy nylon polyester fabric. It's not the harness that really bothers me. It's the weathered winch that always sits on a track around the beam and the line I'm hanging from. Further down the walkway, I could see Izzy, standing at the entrance to inside 37, one hand on his hip, the other scratching the balding spot on his head while talking to Herb and Elijah. 2. "What are you all standing around for?" I asked as I approached them. They all looked at me, with disbelief at the gall I had. "What are you doing standing around?" Izzy turned and placed his other hand on his opposite hip. "You got a lot of nerve, kids, showing up late and then talking down to us for standing around waiting on you." I laughed. "It's not like you were eager to work, Iz." "Hey, the sooner we get the job done, the sooner we get to go home." I agreed with him, actually. "Then let's get it done." Elijah stepped close to me, then said, "I guess you weaseled your way out of interior, didn't you?" Elijah was skinnier than I was and a few inches shorter than me as well. His hard hat pressed bunches of matted red hair out along his neck and over his ears, and he wore an orange jacket that was at least 2 sizes too big for him. Comparatively, after seeing his jacket, the one I was wearing felt rather snug. "I thought you liked working interior," I said. "I do. Well, I did until BS got mad at me last month." "I'm not very happy with you either," said Herb gravely. "Be sure that your belt is tightly fastened to you this time." "It is." He pulled the belt tighter around his waist, placing the prong of the buckle through another hole. "It better be." I started to walk past them, then stopped. Something didn't feel quite right on this part of the walkway. I looked down at my feet, staring through the mesh of metal. The metal was dark and splotched. It felt weaker and loose under my weight. "Well, look at that," said Izzy. "Found us some more rust, did ya?" "I guess so." I got down on my hands and knees to take a closer look. "It looks pretty bad." Izzy made a grunt of disapproval as he crouched down, making his way under the railing, trying to peer at the underside. Elijah and Herb had also come along for a closer look. "Yep," said Izzy as he pulled himself to his feet. "Looks pretty bad, all right." I managed to get my body far enough under the railing for a better look. Under the walkway, which was heavily rusted, I saw a pipe that had a large hole from corrosion, and just beyond, I could see a twisted rainbow of wiring, all wrapped together, fully exposed to the harsh environment. A few yards away, to my left, there was a glass-red orb, which would flicker with red light on and off every few seconds. It was dim, and better seen during the night. There was no telling during the day if it was working or not, and if the wires had been damaged, depending on which one, many of the lights may not have been functioning at all. I pulled myself up. "Better let Boss know he needs to get the Melties out here, and a buzzer. This looks like it's going to be more than just a scraper's job." Izzy laughed. "The buzzer you might be able to get, but not the Melty." "Why not?" I asked. "You're getting closer to the Day of Ascension, and the city always has extra projects for the Melties when it comes close to celebrating stuff like that. And besides, this year's supposed to be an extravagant one. 150 years. He raised his arms to the sky and shouted, "The Quasquicentennial!" I rolled my eyes. The Day of Ascension, the biggest and grandest holiday we have. I remember liking it more as a child because we were excused from school during the duration of the celebrating and festivities, which often lasted about 3 or 4 days. But this year had been generating a lot more buzz between the citizens since it was to be the 125th year since ascending to the city. To me, it was just another number, another mark on the endless calendar that we are ever present in the sky, looming above the earth. I don't even know what exactly we're supposed to be celebrating. I understood the basic reason, the day we remember our escape from the perils of the earth below us, but even then I am skeptical. We were never really told what perils it was that our ancestors escaped. In school, the teachers remained mysterious about it, never letting us know. And as for the recreation halls, public library, and historical archives, there isn't anything available for us to read about what actually happened during the so-called tribulation years. There are plenty of articles and documents about the earth before the fog, but not so much about the time of its arrival, what caused it, and why we can't be near it, why it's always there. There are some writings that have been released that briefly mention that there was an epidemic that was believed to be subsequent from the unlifting white menace, but this was just the general public speculation. If anyone knew any truth about the fog and the tragedies that really befell the earth before heaven's existence, it would be the governing committee. However, I knew they wouldn't provide any answers, so these things are best left to the imagination. Either way, I said, it can't go on too much longer without being fixed. 3. The two most difficult parts of my job is lowering myself down under the winch and getting myself back up safely onto the scaffold. But before I can even go down along the support beams, I have to make sure that all is in working order with the interior scraper. Both jobs are dangerous with some similarities, but there are some major differences as well. Working interior means that you are inside the beam, which means that you have less room to work in. This space is tight at times, especially at the flange, where you pass in between one segment into another. The inward brim of each piece of the shafts decreases the diameter considerably, making it more difficult to squeeze past from one to the next segment. Some have come to call these spots death grips. This is because it's not far-fetched to assume that one could get stuck, and there wouldn't be any way for someone to come to your rescue. The other danger is lack of oxygen. Inside the beams, there isn't any airflow. And the only entrance for air is at the opening at the top where we enter. Because of this, we use an air pump at the top with a hose that has to be lowered down as the scraper makes their descent. Just like Izzy is my winch operator, Herb is Elijah's pump operator. There isn't much room between the walls and metal rungs for scrapers to climb down, so it's also the air pump operator's job to send the necessary supplies as they are needed. This includes primers, which, fortunately, I have attached to the side of my harness. Herb already had the pump humming and had the hose going down the shaft. Elijah then tugged on his tool belt once more, clicked the light on his hard hat, and stepped into the darkened tube. I continued to the exterior portion where I would be lowered down. Izzy inspected the winch before I hooked up to the line. It kicks to life, making an irritable grinding sound as if all the metal parts are forcibly running together. He unreeled a few feet of the line from the winch, which swayed lightly over the white abyss. He stopped and reversed it, reeling it back in. "Looks all good to me," he said. I reached for my harness and fastened it tightly to my body. Then I took the numerous items Izzy brought with him necessary for the job, placing the tools on my belt, then strap a can of primer to one end of the harness and a can of sealant to the other. Izzy then picked up a handheld radio from a cluster of items. "Don't want to forget this," he said, handing me the radio, which had a long black coil of wire that connected to a microphone. Izzy also had a radio, which he had already placed on his jacket and then keyed it. "Can you hear me?" he asked into the radio as it crackled. I had just finished placing the mic on my shoulder. It crackled as I keyed it. "Yes," I replied. The radio is a lifesaver at best. Without it, there'd be no way to communicate with such a long distance from the winch operator to the dangler, and the gusts of winds were so loud that we wouldn't be able to hear each other without them. Glad it's all working, he said. Gotta wait a bit before boss can come and tell you if we can go or not. It's my dad's most important rule. He has to say when and when we can't ascend. I looked back up toward the stairs I'd come down from, and he was nowhere in sight. He is usually so very prompt when it came to security checks. He must be caught up in something. I hope it doesn't take too long. Tonight is the initiation of the Quasquicentennial, and my wife, well, she won't be happy if I'm late due to work. They are initiating it tonight? I'm puzzled. It's at least 2 weeks away. It's just a pep rally, really. The mayor will be there speaking about it and giving everyone a rundown of what they plan to do for it. Kind of like a preview. Then there's supposed to be music and dancing, and if we're lucky, something to eat. I doubted the latter, since the governing committee had been supplying citizens with reports of food shortages and that there would also be some additional rationing of certain foods. And then I thought about how the Quasquicentennial may have had something to do with all of that. Some propaganda ploy conceived by the governing committee. Simple, really. There is a food shortage due to some complication of the cultivation cells, but they've made it far worse than it really is, and all the while secretly storing food for the Quasquicentennial commencement. Suddenly, there is a surplus of food for everyone, ensuring the public that the governing committee has had the problem fixed. It may all be conspiracy theories, but that is how I think. I became very curious and analytical about why some things happen. And if there are others who think about these things the way I do, then they, like me, aren't asking questions openly. What good would it do? There is no way to challenge any authority here. The thought was suddenly whisked away as Izzy pointed out that my dad was walking our way, which I hadn't even seen him come down the stairs. 4. After my dad performed his full inspection, he gave us his approval to begin the tedious job. I start by climbing over the edge where the winch is and slowly lower myself under it. I hang there for a moment as Izzy then pulled the lever that kicks the motor to life and feeds out the metal line. So far, support number 37 seems to have stayed rust-free for the most part. I don't have to go over the radio and tell Iz to stop for about a good 10 feet. I click the mic and it crackled. This is good, I said, then he stopped the winch, causing my body to bounce slightly. I can see that on the right side of the support, there is a smudge of rust that has set in. I remove a small metal hammer-like pick and tap the area of rust to determine how far in it's gotten. I hear a tink, and I am pleased to see that the pick has stopped on the surface. This means that it's going to be an easy fix. I replace the pick and remove a wire brush with metal bristles, which I use to scrape away some of the rust. As I do so, small particles and pieces of the brown stuff flutter away into the breeze and eventually into the misty emptiness. I looked down for a moment and pondered the drop. It was terrifying the first time I came out here suspended above it, paranoid about the thought of falling into it. But I have been able to cope with it, to block that fear. I have grown accustomed to dangling at the mercy of a wire, taking every precaution necessary before I begin. After I've completed scraping away at the visible amount of rust, I pop open a can of primer on my side and dip a soft brush into it. Then lather the goopy white substance on the freshly smoothed area. After it has neatly been spread across, I then pop open a second can of sealant, a clear fluid, and apply it generously over the spot. After it's finished, I get back on the radio. Lower me, Izzy. The mic crackles. You got it. I felt a jolt and begin to descend once more, scanning the beam as I go farther away from the winch. I came to another spot and tell Izzy to stop and repeat the process. Tap, scrape, prime, and sealant. Then go lower again. Stop, tap, scrape, prime, and sealant. I repeat this about 4 more times before I hear Izzy come over the mic. Lunch done, kid. I'm reeling you up now. Time has escaped my thoughts. Has it already been 4 hours? I look up above me. I really am a long ways down. I glanced over at my left, at shaft 38. And I can see that the other scraper hasn't gone as far as I have. He must have had a really tough spot to work on, which makes me feel that today I really have gotten the better end of the stick as far as exterior goes. I am slowly pulled back up to the walkway, passing over my previous stops, observing the work I've done, making sure that it's been done well enough. so that I do not have to redo any of the spots. All of them seem to be in better shape now, and will probably last well over a year before more rust penetrates those areas. After what feels like has taken a century, I am back below the winch, and pull myself up over the side and onto the solid paneling. I unhook the line and begin to unstrap my harness. As I stand, I feel a tingling running through to my feet, all the way up my calves. It always happens after spending hours in the harness, but I'm also used to it. "You got quite a bit done today," said Izzy. "Good," I replied. "That means we won't be here long today." "Another good reason to be paired up with you, kid. You're fast." I smiled and set the harness and supplies down, leaning them against the beam away from the edge. "Are Elijah and Herb done?"
"I'm not entirely sure. Elijah is usually fast too, but he is clumsy. I doubt that they're that close."
I nodded in agreement.
"Going to the cafe today?" I asked. "No, I brought my own. The wife whipped something up for me today. No clue what it is, but it's usually good."
We laughed. We both left the winch and headed back up to the main level of the city. There, by the maintenance vessel, is my father, looking busy as ever over his clipboard and holding the card reader. Izzy and I gave him a disposition on the job's progress, and then we both signed out for lunch with our ID cards. At this, we departed separately, Izzy making his way to a compartment of the vessel where we store personal rations, and me heading to the cafe. 5. The cafe was a bland building, much like the rest of the city. It was the main cafeteria for the city crews and other assorted workers who were served meagerly prepared meals. It was not nearly as grand as the city kitchens, but it was better than most alternatives, such as city-administered rations, which weren't much better than the breakfast I had that morning. I walked through the main entrance into a quickly crowding corridor of men and women in various uniforms and work attire. I found that I recognized so few of them. In this city of such a compressed population, it was almost surprising for how few I really knew. My sense of time had vanished from looking about when I realized that I was standing at the counter across from an older woman in an apron and hairnet. She stared at me blankly from her fading brown eyes. "Afternoon," she said as she held out her hand reader for my ID card. "Good afternoon," was my reply, and I handed it to her. She slid the card through the reader and it beeped its acceptance. 21 points today. It's spaghetti." She handed me my meal tray with a fork and napkin. "Enjoy." I said thank you and scooted the tray along the counter to the first line worker who handed me a plate of noodles smothered in red sauce. It didn't look very appetizing. It looked more like a pile of worms doused in blood. I slid the tray down the line to the next worker who handed me a small brown bowl of salad that consisted of browning lettuce, and finally to a third worker who gave me a very crispy bread roll. I took my tray to another counter adjacent to the main line where cups of water were neatly placed for the taking. I took one, placed it on my tray, and looked out at the gray-walled room of four long rows of tables. Most of the seats were already taken. I scanned the rows to see if Tristan had managed to get a lunch break at the same time I had. With his training, he never really had a set lunch. However, it was often one of the only times that we could see each other. I could remember when he started training. He worked through the night and spent most of his days sleeping, and that was when I rarely got to see him. But it wasn't all that much better when he switched to daylight training. Eventually, I spotted a small group of black security uniforms at the far end of the dining hall, and Tristan was among them. He looked up from where he sat and waved at me to come over. As I came closer to where he and the other officers sat, the amount of people at the tables began to grow thin. As usual, most patrons sat closer toward the front of the dining hall, away from where security sat, leaving them a nice area all to themselves. Tristan stood up with his tray, said something to one of the officers, who all briefly glanced over at me, and then went back to their chatter. Tristan's helmet was no longer on, making him less intimidating. We met halfway and took a seat next to each other. "Have fun dangling today?" he asked. "I guess. It's not really that fun anymore. When I was learning how to, it was exciting, but now I'm used to it. What about you? Keeping the city of heaven safe?" He grimaced slightly. "It's been a slow day. Earlier today, there was a pursuit of a guy who stole some fruit, but my trainer and I weren't anywhere near it when it happened. Images of the man being shocked and violently convulsing on the ground flashed in my brain. I saw it happen when I was taking Corey to the greenhouses. "It's too bad, really," he said. "All that trouble for some half-rotted fruit? It's embarrassing." I was curious as to which part was embarrassing. The man stealing rotten fruit? Or was it the part where the man was caught? "He won't be punished too badly," said Tristan. "He will be locked up for a little while, and the governing committee will hear his crimes and give him a light sentence. But he has done this before." "So you think he'll do it again?" "Probably. It seems that people like him always do it again." I stuck my fork into the noodles and twisted them around the utensil. I took a bite of the mushy food and chewed. "This stuff isn't so bad when you're hungry," I said. "I actually like it," said Tristan, taking a bite for himself. The lights of the entire facility dimmed slightly, which meant that it was time for the daily news report in the city. Along the walls of the hall, there were large black frames every few feet with nothing in them until the daily newsreels. There was a lifting sound of music that began to fill the room, followed by each of the empty frames suddenly coming to life with three-dimensional images of the city, which morphed into the golden-encrusted emblem, pulling away to reveal a very well-dressed and neatly groomed man and woman with broad, shining smiles on their faces. The man spoke first. "Good afternoon, citizens. You are now watching the daily report of our fair city of heaven. We have a lot of exciting news for you today," the woman then spoke. "That's right, Mark. Today we'll be bringing you all the newest details and updates of the up-and-coming celebration of the Day of Ascension." "That's right, Heather. There is a lot that we'll be going over about the Day of Ascension, but don't tell them too much yet. We still have a very special announcement that we'll be presenting to you live from the steps of the governing building, presented by Mayor Barrett." Tristan gave a little grunt. "That man has no idea what he's doing." I continued to watch the report while breaking off a piece of the tough bread and dug out the soft bread from within, leaving a hollowed brown shell. "It's always an honor when Mayor Barrett addresses the public," said Heather. "Yes, we are blessed to have such a hard-working man like Mayor Barrett in office. In fact, all of the governing committee does a phenomenal job keeping the public's best interests," was Mark's enthusiastic reply. That comment did stir some remarks throughout the hall, including from Tristan. I myself felt somewhat indifferent. I did have to agree that the reporters were making him out to sound like someone greater than he was. "The Quasquicentennial," I said. "That's what I've been told they're calling it this year."
"I heard that too."
"Let me guess, you'll be working through the whole thing."
"Some of it.
They try to make it where everyone can get some time off to celebrate."
"I've heard it's supposed to be much longer this year."
Tristan shrugged.
"I guess we're about to be told." Heather spoke. "And now we go live to the governing building where the mayor will be giving his speech from the steps."
The scene cut away to the governing building.
"Looks like there is quite a turnout for the announcements," said Mark. "Yes, it is," agreed Heather. "It looks like most of the citizens are excited to hear the eagerly awaited news."
Tristan had finished all of the spaghetti on his tray and slid it away from him.
"I'm excited about this year in a way," he said.
"Why?" Tristan's face turned plum red. He paused and grew redder.
It's about May.
Maybelline Taylor, the crying girl. Tristan and Maybelline had been together for a very long time. It started back when we were still in school. He and I, of course, had graduated before her. And when he became a trainee for security, the pace of their relationship picked up.
"What about her?" I asked.
"I'm going to..."
Mark interrupted.
"And now... here he is, ladies and gentlemen, the mayor of our grand city, the city of heaven's Mayor Barrett."
We heard the applause from the crowd and then watched as Mayor Barrett gracefully exited the building and stationed himself on top of the stair, smiling and waving at the audience. He was a pint-sized man with a receding hairline and bushy eyebrows. He squinted his eyes from the conniving smile that stretched across his face. He wore a black gown that had been re-sewn and hemmed so that it wouldn't get caught under his feet. There came four more persons dressed in black gowns who stood behind him, the committee, standing tall and illustrious. Barrett threw up his hands to silence the patrons.
"Citizens of heaven," he began, "I thank you all for joining me on this beautiful afternoon."
There was another applause.
"There is much to discuss, and I know that you're all dying to hear about it. I can hardly wait to tell you, but..." There are some issues that I need to address to the public before anything further can be discussed.
He probably won't talk about the real issues, I said. Tristan's redness had vanished, and he was now focused on the projection. I'll tell you about May after this.
There have been some rumors, Barrett started. Some very disheartening rumors. Rumors that may have been led to be perceived as fact, which renders some feeling hopeless and scared about the future. I'm talking about the rumor of low rations.
There was a slight murmur through the cafe, as well as through the crowd before the mayor. I was wrong. He is talking about the main concerns.
Citizens, I can assure you that although we are in a slight period of conservation, there isn't a threat to our food sources. Our team of scientists and researchers are working at full tilt to bring the same abundance of food from the greenhouses as it did from the early days. This brings me to the topic of this year's Day of Ascension.
Here it comes, I thought.
As you all know, this year is going to be a very special year. This year marks the 125th year of our reign, the quasquicentennial.
At that announcement, the crowd began to cheer, and there was a loud blast from a siren which was commonly used for emergency drills. And as it sounded, four silk banners of vibrant blue unraveled along the pillars of the governing building, each one reading 125 vertically in white numbers with gold trim. The silk elegantly rippled as it hung from the pillars. This display had never been done in the past. The prior years were far less grand and didn't have nearly the spectacle that was promised for this year.
We will begin the festivities for this monumental occasion tonight with a commencement ball at the Public Center, including performed music provided by our chamber choir. Citizens, I guarantee that this year's Day of Ascension, without a doubt, will be the most sumptuous celebration yet in the City of Heaven.
More cheering came from the crowd, and then the camera cut back to the hosts of the news. Mark and Heather both went into a spiral of scripted excitement and joy over the short but spirited speech given by the mayor. "The ball will be perfect for tonight," said Tristan. I asked him why, but before he could get any words out, his field training officer butted in. "Back to patrol," said his superior. "Yes, sir," replied Tristan. "I'll talk to you more at the ball tonight." He then stood up with his empty tray and left, towing behind the other officers. I followed shortly after, returning my tray and making my way back to finish my shift. I didn't really care to go to the commencement ball, but I knew that Corey would want to go, and Tristan wanted to tell me something. The rest of my shift was the same as the first on support 37. Tap, scrape, prime, sealant. Then repeat the process for another 3 hours until I'm told we're done for the day. After my shift's end, we all met at the equipment transport where my dad gave us a quick briefing on the productivity of the shift and a heads up for what to expect the following days. After that, the others departed. I stayed with my dad as he prepared to drive the transport back to the city garage.
"You better go get your sister from the greenhouses," he said.
"She'll want to go to the commencement ball tonight. Are you going?"
He took a deep breath. "It's not really my kind of thing anymore, but you should take Corey for just a few hours. Not too long, though. We still have to wake up and do the same routine tomorrow."
"She'll love it," I replied. With that, my dad stepped into the transport and brought it to a rumbling life, with a heavy gust of black exhaust and a terrible whining of gears. I watched him hover away, then walked to the greenhouses.